Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't
you know we're gonna have a Solartopia?
We started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dara Williams singing the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns, and there's an airplane flying overhead. I am outdoors here in Los Angeles. I don't want to tell you the temperature for all you people in the East, but it ain't bad. So, listen, today is the day that Paul Ryan has announced that he's not going to run again. It's as good a way to wake up to news as any. I got two words for you, Paul. Good riddance. Don't show your face anymore. You spent your whole life trying to destroy Social Security and Medicare. I wish you'd just get out now and open up that speaker seat. But anyway, it's great news that you're gone. So we have an amazing show today. Two huge topics of vital importance to all the world and certainly all Americans. I got two great activists to start with. Tim Judson of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tim, you with us?
I am. Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you. And Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear. You with us, Kevin?
Yes, I am. Hey, Harvey.
Fantastic. And we're going to be joined at some point by John Brakey, B-R-A-K-E-Y, from Arizona. And he is primarily an election protection activist and has done spectacular work on preserving the, or actually restoring, or even for the first time getting election results that are reliable and that we can count on. But John also lives in Arizona, and we're going to be talking with Kevin and Tim, among other things, about the three nukes at Palo Verde in Arizona and some amazing developments there. But let's start with you, Tim. We're going to talk, I'd like to go through the inventory right now of nuclear power plants that are about on the brink of shutdown. We are seeing, and this is what we're going to deal with in this first half hour, we are seeing the total disintegration of the American nuclear power industry. Let's do it by the numbers. Tim and Kevin, I had sent to me a list of the reactors that are presumed to be shutting down within the next couple of years or that are on the brink. I want to start with the most important, the ones that are on the cutting edge right now, which is the four reactors owned by First Energy. That would be Perry near Cleveland, Davis-Besse near Toledo, and then Beaver Valley 1 and 2 near Pittsburgh. Now, First Energy has announced that they are going to go bankrupt. They've been morally bankrupt, of course, forever, but they now are going to go financially bankrupt. But our understanding, my understanding, and both you guys know more about this than me, is that there was a lunch or some kind of McDonald's stir fry there with Donald Trump, and there's a play being made for $8 billion to keep these four reactors going. Tim, do you want to start with that? And then let Kevin.
Sure, Harvey. Yeah, I mean, this has been coming for some time. First Energy has been pushing for bailout after bailout for their nukes in Ohio for the last 4 years, and they basically failed to be able to get anything done either that the state legislature in Ohio would approve or that the courts would find legal, and so they've been backed into a corner. And it's actually not First Energy, the whole corporation, that's declaring bankruptcy. It's just their subsidiary that owns these power plants that's declaring bankruptcy because they can't afford to pay these billions of dollars in loans that they've got. And so after failing to get the state legislature in Ohio to jump and pass a multi-billion dollar bailout bill, They declared, you know, that this subsidiary was going to go bankrupt a couple weeks ago, and they filed notices that they were going to be shutting down all four of these reactors over the next 3 years. They did this thing through the back door where they basically sent a letter sent a petition to the Department of Energy, asking the Department of Energy to use this obscure federal law that allows the Department of Energy in times of war or national emergency to order the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to bail out power plants. And so the Trump administration, the reports out this week are that the Trump administration is taking this seriously and may actually act on it.
My God. Kevin, I'll let you jump in before I go crazy here.
Well, like we've talked about on past shows, some of these reactors, all of them actually, are so dangerous that they should have been shut down a long time ago. So Dave Espessi, more close calls with catastrophe than maybe any other single reactor in the world, lacks a containment structure at this point because it's so severely cracked. So, you know, they should have been shut down for safety reasons a very long time ago. So here is a bankrupt FirstEnergy nuclear operating company making an emergency petition application to the Energy Secretary and hiring Rick Perry's former campaign manager for his presidential run back in 2016 as a top lobbyist. He was one of the two people who had dinner with Trump last Wednesday or Thursday, and Trump came out of the meeting saying, yeah, we're going to take a look at this 202. And Tim pointed out in a tweet that maybe, you know, Trump should have Energy 101 before he goes to 202 because he doesn't even understand what he's doing. And I should point out that $8 billion figure, I've seen it from the likes of Dick Munson at Environmental Defense Fund in Ohio. That applies to the whole PJM grid from the Atlantic to Illinois. So what FirstEnergy is doing is saying, hey, you know, all of the coal and nuclear in this whole neck of the woods, the largest grid in the country, 65 million consumers get their electricity from it. All of the coal and nuke should be entitled to this Energy Department emergency bailout, not just us. So they're trying to wrap themselves in both industries to, you know, justify this outrageous request.
God. Of course, we all know that the moron in the White House loves coal and doesn't know anything about nuclear, that's for sure. All right, we started with that. I want to jump real quick. We're going to come back to this, of course. But Tim Judson, you are at NERSC involved, and I'm sure Kevin is too, in the lawsuit over the four reactors. I mean, before we jump up and down on Trump, we got to deal with Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York. So the four reactors in New York State that we're about to shut, and then Cuomo jumped in. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, you know, like we talked about on your show a couple months ago, we're suing the state of New York, NERSC and Hudson River Sloop Clearwater and three other groups. And Beyond Nuclear was actually part of the lawsuit initially, but a judge dismissed a bunch of, over 50 people and organizations that had tried to join with us. But we're going to court to stop this $7.5 billion bailout that Governor Cuomo pushed through a year and a half ago. And it's actually kind of, you know, it's actually really significant. You know, we just passed the 1 year anniversary of this bailout being in place. And New Yorkers have already spent almost $500 million subsidizing these dirty old dangerous nukes on the shore of Lake Ontario. But, you know, we're going to go to court this summer and, if we're successful, the subsidy will get, will get repealed. And hopefully, we'll be seeing some of these old reactors in New York start shutting down too.
So here we have eight, count them, eight old, dangerous, dying, decrepit nuclear power plants. One is the hands of the idiot in the White House. The other is in the hands of the jerk of the governor of New York. That's almost 10%. Of the nukes, well, it's about 12%, about 8% of the nukes in the United States, right? So that's eight reactors. Now, what other reactors, Kevin, we'll start with you, are on the brink or have announced shutdowns of the 99 or 100, however you count it, reactors licensed to operate in the country?
Well, the nearest term ones I can think of include Oyster Creek, New Jersey, which happens to be the oldest in the country. And I think that the current shutdown announcement was October of this year, which is a year earlier than they had been saying. And it's because of economic duress and their failure, their lobbyists' failure to secure a bailout in New Jersey. So that's good news because that's a Fukushima twin design, and it's pushing 50 years old at this point. And
okay,
the other one,
fine.
Another infamous,
another
infamous name is Three Mile Island Unit 1, the one that did not melt down in 1979. So it, too, is now announcing, last I knew, a 2019, I forget the month, I think June 2019 closure, while at the same time its lobbyists are trying to get Pennsylvania or anybody else to bail it out. And the culprit here is Exelon. So a lot of what we've talked about in the last few minutes, the upstate New York reactors, Oyster Creek, New Jersey, Three Mile Island, Unit 1, this is Exelon out of Chicago, the beneficiary of those subsidies in New York, the beneficiary of subsidies in Illinois, trying to get subsidies in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So hopefully those two shutdowns will happen before any bailout.
Okay, so that's 10. Then what? Jim,
well, then we got Pilgrim and the Pilgrim reactor on Cape Cod in Massachusetts that'll be shutting down in 2019 as well. And then the Palisades reactor in Michigan in 2022.
Right,
before Palisades, actually, the two Indian Point reactors in New York, 25 miles north of New York City on the Hudson River, those are scheduled to shut down in 2020 and 2021.
So that's 14 reactors with near or potential shutdown dates. Now, what about the three in Illinois?
Well, there are three reactors in Illinois that are being bailed out right now too, just like the ones in New York. And those are the Quad Cities 1 and 2 reactors, on the Mississippi River next to Iowa, and the Clinton reactor in the middle of the state. All three of those nukes had been scheduled to shut down in the next year or two until the bailout was put through about a year ago.
And what are their projected shutdown dates now?
Well, the Quad City reactors are in the early 2030s. That's when they're licensed to operate to. And the Clinton reactor is licensed until, I think, I guess 2025 right now. It's a question of whether Exelon thinks that it's going to be able to get Illinois to continue this bailout for the Illinois reactors. Whether it's going to ask the NRC for a 20-year license extension, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a 20-year license extension to continue operating Clinton into the 2040s.
Okay, so we're up to 17 reactors that have near-term shutdown dates and or are being bailed out. Okay, Kevin, you want to jump in on Diablo Canyon?
So that was kind of an unprecedented thing because Pacific Gas and Electric decided that they would not go for a 20-year license extension. And those are really slow-motion rubber stamps by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. If a company applies for it, they are going to get it no matter how dangerous the reactor is, no matter how much money it's losing, which isn't NRC's purview necessarily, the finances, but the safety certainly is. And NRC still rubber stamps these 20-year license extensions. So at Diablo Canyon, Unit 1 and 2, they currently have shutdown dates of 2024 and 2025. That just marks the end of 40 years, their initial licensing period. Groups like Mothers for Peace and San Luis Obispo are hoping very deeply that it'll happen sooner than that, but that's the current plan that got hammered out between the company and environmental groups, including NRDC and Friends of the Earth and Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, as well as the workforce at the plant, the unions involved. So there's still a lot of bureaucratic processes playing themselves out in California, but those are the projected shutdown dates as of now.
So that's 19 reactors that are either being bailed out or have near-term shutdown dates. I just got a story today. Maybe, Tim, you know about this. There's going to be a ballot issue in Arizona, and we'll be joined by John Brakey soon, and we can ask him about it, in favor of renewables in Arizona. And the owners of the Palo Verde nuclear reactors, three of them there, it's actually the biggest single nuke site in America, have said that if that ballot initiative passed, they'll shut Palo Verde, which I would certainly love. That would put us up to, what, 22 now? Are either of you familiar with what's going on with this ballot initiative in Arizona and the future of the Palo Verde plant?
Sure. Well, this is news just breaking today from Arizona, but I'm not familiar with the details of what's being proposed for this solar energy initiative. But Arizona Public Service, which is the big utility in Arizona that owns Palo Verde, has been trying for the last few months to try to weasel into the renewable energy business, not by actually building any renewable energy, but by getting the state public utility commission to say that nuclear is a source of renewable energy, and that hasn't been going very well for them, recently. But this ballot initiative to really expand solar in the state is moving forward, and Arizona Public Service, is threatening. Basically, they're trying to pull the political levers to squash this ballot initiative, by threatening to close the plant and lay off the workers.
Kevin, have you got anything to add to that one?
Well, just to point out, like you said, Harvey, that Palo Verde units 1, 2, and 3. By megawattage, it's the largest nuclear power plant in the country, and it just so happens to be located in some of the best solar PV potential land in North America. So it's really, it's a Rube Goldberg machine that, is very Orwellian. One aspect of it is that there's not a lot of water to work with out there in the Arizona desert. So the way they cool the plant, the largest nuclear power plant in the United States, is with the treated sewage water of Phoenix, which they pump out there some 35 miles to serve as cooling water for this nuclear plant. So, the energy losses of doing that for decades on end alone, So companies like Arizona Public Service and other owners of Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant and just giant coal plants out there have been very effective at sabotaging solar in Arizona for a long time. So I can only hope that solar comes back in a big way because the potential is so great in that state.
Well, it just so happens that I'm talking to you from Los Angeles, and I am in the district of the Department of Water and Power, which owns 10% of Palo Verde. So this is near and dear to me. And let's hope that we can pass this solar referendum and that the owners will keep their word and shut the reactors. Okay, so we're up to what now? If we count in, well, we won't count in Palo Verde because they haven't set a date, but we're up to about 20 reactors now that have near-term shutdown dates or are being bailed out. Did we miss any? What about the Cooper in Nebraska?
Well, we're in the realm of the nukes that are probably uneconomical to operate, but for whatever reason the owners haven't decided to close them yet, and so certainly Cooper, this relatively small boiling water reactor in Nebraska, should be one of the next ones on the list, but there's several others that are also coming up right now as well. And their owners are asking for bailouts from the states, but it's not really clear that they would actually close anytime soon, even if they don't get a bailout. That's kind of the level of greed that's going on with a lot of these nuclear power plant companies.
So do we have any others on the list that we've missed that have short-term shutdown dates?
None that have shutdown dates. But like I said, there's several others where the owners are threatening to close the plants, if they don't get more bailouts. So, for instance, there's the Millstone 2 and 3 reactors in Connecticut, where Dominion Energy is trying to get the state to decide to let nuclear compete with renewable energy for multi-year contracts with the state's utilities that would be these above market rates. And also PSE&G, the big utility in New Jersey, as well as Exelon that also operates in New Jersey, are pushing a bill for the state legislature to provide a subsidy of $300 million a year for the Salem 1 and 2 and Hope Creek reactors, which, again, are still profitable, but PSE&G says they're not profitable enough.
God, there's no end. Maybe there is an end. That's the point of the show. Maybe there is an end to the guys. So we're talking about 20% of the reactors in the country now.
And there's more, Harvey. I got more for you.
Okay. Let's hear it.
Also Xcel Energy, which is a big utility in the Midwest, operates in Wisconsin and Minnesota and some other states. They're pushing the state legislature in Minnesota for legislation that would guarantee their ability to recover their costs for the three reactors in Minnesota, the Prairie Island 1 and 2 and Monticello reactors, all of which are old and small and uneconomical. But Xcel wants to basically get their costs pre-authorized, basically so that they don't have to go to the state utility commission to get to actually ask for more and more money.
All right, Kevin, you got another one to throw in there?
Well, I just wanted to point out. I mean, we're talking a lot of dollars and cents here, but there's so many other aspects to this too. Like at Prairie Island, Minnesota, the two reactors there were built against the will of the Prairie Island Indian community, on whose land that is. And this is in very close proximity. We're talking just hundreds of yards from the nuclear power plant to the nearest residence, the tribal daycare center. The tribe did not have a casino back in the late 60s, early 70s, so they didn't really have the resources to fight back, but they now do have a casino. They do have revenues. They can hire lawyers, and they are fighting as best they can to shut down the nuke, to deal with the radioactive waste situation on the island. I mean, this is a floodplain in the Mississippi River, not unlike the Missouri River at Cooper in Nebraska. So the safety risks of, extreme weather. We just had a major historic flood on the Missouri River back in 2011, summer of 2011, that really put the Fort Calhoun reactor upstream of Cooper in real danger. So we're living on borrowed time at these major river reactors, and that's a whole, another kettle of fish.
God almighty. I mean, it's terrifying. I would have to say that this is probably the most dangerous time in the history of the nuclear industry, bad as it's been. You got all these reactors going down. They're certainly not going to put in the maintenance diligence that is required, because so many of these reactors are clearly on the brink of shutdown. That's one of the big issues at Diablo Canyon, of course. Is that if it's going to shut in 2024 and 5, and we hope to God it shuts earlier, they're not going to do the big capital cost things that are required. Let's jump back now to the reactors in Arizona. We've been joined by John Brakey. John, are you on?
Harvey, good to be here.
Yes. John Brakey, you're on. Okay, so
hi.
In the second half of the show, we're going to talk to John Brakey from Arizona about election protection. But, John, you are in the heartland of the Palo Verde nuclear reactors, and we had an announcement today that the owners of Palo Verde have threatened to shut those three reactors. I would like to say promised, but if this solar referendum going on the ballot passes. Are you from Arizona, have been following any of that at all?
I'm guilty that I haven't, because all I do is elections, and I've been traveling all over the country, but it's something I'm very concerned about, and it's something that motivates me to do what I do, just because of fear of nuclear and things that are going on worldwide, really.
Okay, so we'll come back to you, because you're going to be...
Yeah, please.
If there is a referendum in Arizona on solar, we'll start at the top of the half hour and talk to you about the state of the electronic and other voting machines. Let me jump back now with the top of the news with Tim and Kevin. Tim Judson of Nuclear Information Resource Service, Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. This announcement this news that two emissaries have gone to meet with the idiot in chief and over McDonald's hamburgers have discussed the possibility of the use of an emergency federal law to bail out four reactors. Can you get a little more specific about that, Kevin Camps? What is actually involved with this 202, and how can we fight it?
Well, just to clarify, yes, First Energy is most concerned about its four atomic reactors, two in Ohio, two in Pennsylvania, as well as several coal plants that are on life support, and they'd like these massive bailouts now from the Department of Energy under the Federal Power Act, Section 202C. But as I mentioned earlier, if you look at the emergency petition, First Energy is actually calling for this bailout for the entire PJM grid, which is 80 plants, both coal and nuclear. And so when you add it all up, that's where this $8 billion per year figure comes from for this emergency bailout. And coming out of that dinner with First Energy's top lobbyists, a former Rick Perry presidential campaign manager named Jeff Miller, I believe is his name, was one of them, Trump seemed pretty amenable. You know, he said, we're going to take a little look-see at this 202, see what we can do. So unfortunately, given those kind of personal connections, that kind of idiocy, as you put it, outrage, absurdity, this thing may have some traction at the White House and at the Energy Department, but I think there's real strong grounds for critics, including environmental groups, consumer advocates, competitor generators of electricity, to take this thing to court because it's a real stretch of the Federal Power Act.
Well, is there any kind of, Tim Judson, is there any kind of civil resistance that could throw a monkey wrench in the process of Trump giving them this money?
Well, I think like Kevin said, you know, this is something that, you know, they're trying to do an end run around any kind of civil process. But like, you know, like I said, like Kevin said, if, you know, if the administration does this, then there's going to be a whole, you know, bevy of legal challenges from everybody from NRDC and Public Citizen, you know, environmental groups, you know, to the fossil fuel industry as well. So, you know, I think that there's going to be a challenge to it if it happens. And I think that's really why the Trump administration is kind of wringing its hands right now, trying to figure out exactly how they're going to help their friends.
God, it's so insane. And of course, Trump has recently handed about $8 billion at the Vogtle plant in Georgia to continue building that one. Isn't that correct?
It was
what they did was they approved an additional $3.7 billion in taxpayer guaranteed loans to that project in order to sweeten the pot for the state regulators to feel comfortable with not canceling that project a few months ago.
But so that was on top of $8.3 billion that Obama gave under Energy Secretary Moniz some years ago, 2014. So you round it off, and it's an even $12 billion in federal taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantees down there. That's 22 times Solyndra.
So is this a done deal at Vogtle with the new Trump money coming in there? And has the decision made that they're going to continue building Vogtle?
Well, they've decided to continue building it, but this is a real slippery slope they're on. You know, I mean, as of a year ago, the utilities in South Carolina that are building the Summer 2 and 3 reactors, the twin project to the one in Georgia, you know, said they were going to continue, and they were going and getting their rate increases and to where the people in South Carolina are paying 20% of their electricity bills to this nuclear project that's never going to operate. And yet 6 months later, you know, that project was canceled. So it's really going to they've got another at least 5 or 6 years of trying to build these reactors in Georgia, and they're going to have to keep on coming forward with rate increases and requesting more money. And at some point, the rope's going to run out.
Man, what a mess. So, I mean, the good news is that we got 20 reactors in this country that are really on a downbound spiral. The bad news is,
and I got one more for you too, Harvey.
Oh, let's hear it.
So there's also a tiny reactor in in Iowa called Duane Arnold.
Right.
That is owned by NextEra, the big power company that's based in Florida. And that reactor is just like these others, totally uneconomical, but they've got a sweetheart contract with the local utility. And just about a month ago, NextEra said that if they don't renew that contract in 2025, then they're going to close Duane Arnold then as well. And the irony to that is that, Iowa already is generating, more than 12 times as much electricity from wind as they get from nuclear power. And, and the idea that they're going to that they're going to bail out a nuclear plant, when they're able to build, that much more wind would be pretty crazy.
2025 is still a long way off. I did just read, by the way, that wind energy has had greater global capacity and production than global nuclear. And I just read within the last week or two that solar has now also surpassed nuclear capacity and generation. Have you guys seen that?
I think the amount of generation for solar and for wind is greater than nuclear. The distinction being that the total amount of electricity that's generated is about equal at this point.
From wind and solar versus nuclear, or just from versus nuclear?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Kevin, you were kind of drowned out there. Did you have something you wanted to add?
Oh, just that Ken Bassong in D.C. with the Sunday campaign will often put out a press release when new announcements like that come out about how well renewables are doing nationally in the U.S. or even internationally around the world.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, listen, you guys, this has been a great update. We could talk for another hour or two, but we got John Brakey waiting in the wings. Kevin Camps, how do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, our website is www.beyondnuclear.org.
And Tim Judson?
Yeah, and NIRS is at www.nirs.org.
All right, so listen, both of you guys, if you'll send me whatever legal and other actions are going on, make sure I'm in the loop for the memos and stuff. Top of the list now is these four reactors with First Energy, with these four in upstate New York. These seem to me the most vulnerable in terms of stopping them in the short term. And certainly I think Diablo Canyon is very vulnerable to an earlier shutdown than 2024 and 25. And now it's put Palo Verde on this list. If these owners are saying that they're going to shut if this solar referendum passes, then we got to make 100% sure that thing passes. And so with that, I'm going to segue. Tim and Kevin, you're both welcome to stay on. We're going to talk now with John Brakey from Arizona about what's happening with election protection. And on this glorious day of the announcement that Paul Ryan is not going to run for reelection, I hope to God he's serious about it and we never hear from that guy again. What an awful human being. At any rate, thanks, Tim and Kevin. As I say, you're welcome to stay on. John Brakey, you are one of our leading election protection activists, and we want to hear from you about what's happening. I know you've been in Ohio with a lot of major developments. First of all, though, since we do want to segue, what kind of shape is the electoral process in your home state of Arizona? Can we expect a reliable vote count in this upcoming referendum on solar energy?
You know, that's a hard one to say, and because, out of 50 states, Arizona came in 51st on a poll about how bad we are because they counted D.C., okay? Now, that poll is because of the advocacy work that our group has done for the last 14 years, all the court cases, and exposing it. I don't really think we're the worst, but I think we're up there, okay? Because I have been to the other states, and most recently, Ohio. But one thing about Arizona that was really good for me was to learn from the worst or the best or whatever you want to call it, the benchmark, and work under some of these people and see the scams and the court cases and the cover-ups has helped me sharpen my wit or understanding of how the process. And then I go into Ohio, and then I start going from county to county talking to people. And, of course, Franklin, I guess that's your old home county, right?
Franklin County, Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and, you know, to sit in there and then have them try to game me and say, oh, we love ballot images. They're really good. In fact, we want to get rid of the paper and just keep the images. I'm going, no, you have to have both. And then, you know, I say, well, how are you processing, handling? Then find out that they are destroying them. And then to find out that in both Cuyahoga and in Columbus, that they want to start counting the vote 19 days out, okay? And then to find out that on a daily basis with the absentee votes, that they are using a thumb drive to remove the results and put them in a fireproof safe. That's how exactly Cuyahoga County is doing it, Cleveland. And that safe's 300 feet away. These machines that they're using, these 850s, you know, they have the settings set on destroy the images, and they do that daily, you know. And the whole thing is quite a scam. It really is. That's all I can describe it. Because, you know, all I can say, Harvey, is it's like, you know, I used to complain that 10 days out they knew all the football scores in Arizona. Ohio's got us beat. They know 19 days out, 2 weeks over, who's going to win or lose practically every football game or every race in that county. Because when they start counting early ballot, it's the best pollster that you can have. Because, you know, if you were to do a poll in Pima County or Franklin County, you might poll 500 people. How about if I could poll 30,000 actual voters and give you the numbers? That's pretty devastating, isn't it?
One quick thing, John. It's Cuyahoga. Cuyahoga has been, of course, famous since 1979 when the Cuyahoga River caught fire.
Caught on fire. So, yeah, I remember that.
My brother was there. What happened was that they dumped the ballots from the election into the river and they caught fire. That's what happened. So
I could believe that. Maybe.
Yeah. All right. So tell us, before we proceed here with all the nightmares that are going on, and I understand also, by the way, that Bob Patrakis, our co-conspirator, has a gerrymandering suit ready to go in Ohio also. Is that part of
what
you're
saying? He may, but right now he's filing the suit either tomorrow or Monday in Ohio. And Bob is our lead attorney working with Chris Sauter. And they are going back and forth with the teams and working it and preparing to sue the Secretary of State under a mandamus act type TRO. What we want the judge to do is to order the Secretary of State to follow the law.
All right, so what?
Pretty much
exactly,
a lot to ask for, isn't it?
Exactly and precisely, what are you asking the Secretary of State to do?
We're asking the Secretary of State to do his job and to interpret the law like he should, and then order all of the counties in the state of Ohio that they must preserve the ballot images because they are in the chain of custody. And I cannot emphasize how important it is. In today's world, there are now two official ballots, one that you marked, Harvey, and then the one the machine counted. And they are the same, except one's a picture of it. And as my judge in Pima County said, he said, you know, Pima County, I need to have you, I'm not computer literate, so here's his analogy. If you take voted ballots and then you go ahead and photocopy those voted ballots and then you use the photocopies to count, what makes you think you can destroy them? He then instantly ruled from the bench and said that the side of the activists are right. You cannot destroy them, and I order you to preserve them. And that's what we want to have happen here, too. And if we do that, what have we done? You know,
are you telling me that in Ohio, they have voting machines that will give you a ballot image
of how the people voted?
Not of how people voted. No, these are anonymous ballots. They are pictures of ballots anonymously. Okay?
Okay.
They do not tie back to a voter, but they do tie back to a precinct. And the only way that we could know how you vote is if there was 100 people who voted and they all voted the same way, which is not very likely. Okay? And so these are completely anonymous, but they are exact copies, and ballots in your in that state are a public record, but they're hard to get because they're unique. They're one each. These ballot images, which we're not asking for them, by the way, all we are fighting for is you cannot destroy them. We'll let candidates do that. Does that make sense?
All right. So in Ohio, the machines that they have now, because we've had a lot of controversy, of course, about the nature of the voting machines in Ohio. But
yeah.
Are you saying that the voting machines now being used in Ohio can produce a ballot image that would allow a reliable recount?
There are 7.5 million voters, I believe, in the state of Ohio, registered voters. Of that, there's approximately 2.7 million that vote on machines that create a ballot image of the ballot. And they're mostly in your super large counties. Okay? And is where they are. And it's out of 88 states, 15 have this technology.
88 counties.
Yeah,
but
15
the counties
have it.
That have the technology are in the big counties.
Some small ones. I mean, you know, there's 50. I can't, you know, I can't really say the small ones. I got counties that have this technology that have 10,000 voters, and I have counties that have 880,000 voters. Columbus, I think, has 800,000. And the next county, I think it's like 400,000, but I'm not really counting them because I'm not too sure of this Hart Inner Civic system. It's very old. They do have images, but they cut them up and destroy them, and they make them useless. So I discounted them. And so when I say 2.7, it's quite a number to be able to gauge elections by. Especially what's incredible is that it's in these Democratic counties. Because isn't Cleveland area and Columbus pretty heavily Democratic?
Yeah, the urban areas in Ohio, even Cincinnati, are heavily Democratic. That's,
yeah, well, that's where they're destroying. I wonder why.
Columbus, Cincinnati, Dayton, Toledo, Youngstown,
yeah.
Akron. Those are the major rural urban areas. So
yeah. You know, what I think's going on is somebody – maybe, possibly, protecting the right to cheat now or in some future election. Because we know that if they're getting the football scores early, they know how to launch a fraction magic attack, okay? And if they know that 19 days out, it gives them plenty of time to be able to stick a thumb drive into all these units that they're putting thumb drives in and launch a virus by using what they call an air gap device. That means a thumb drive, okay? They say these things are never hooked to the Internet, but the reality is where they pull the data from is, okay? And at that point right there, fraction magic can change the numbers on the fly. Now, fraction magic, you know what that is, the fractional program, right, Harvey?
Yeah.
Okay, and you think you got a whole vote? You know, you're 100, really, you're 100 little pennies, okay? And we can fractionalize and say, oh, you're a black guy, we're going to give you 3/5 of a vote, okay? And the rest of the white folks, we're going to go ahead and give them 1.35. The guy who found this, that's what he found out of Memphis, Tennessee. Denny Smith, black box voter.
All right, so this lawsuit you want to file, does it require the use of certain kinds of machines?
No. No. It requires them to follow federal and state law, which under a federal election, everything in the chain of custody has to be preserved for 22 months. In a state election, it's only 2 months in the state of Ohio. And we're requiring them to follow the law. We're really bad people, aren't we, to do this? Isn't that awful?
Yeah, so if you win this lawsuit, what will happen to the vote count in Ohio?
I think that we'll take away the impunity of anybody trying to pull any gangs, because the candidates will be able to get the ballot images in these counties, okay? I think that Dennis Kucinich might have a better chance. I think that some people who are counting on the machines to pull for them, they won't be able to, because we're taking away their impunity to cheat. Because fraction magic, like I said, can change the numbers on the fly, but it cannot change a hand-marked paper ballot, which is hard to get in your state. But you know that ballot images? It's a public record. And by the way, you heard about New York today, right?
No, let's hear it.
New York, case that's been going on for years. Douglas Kilner, who's the State Board of Elections co-chair for the Democratic Party statewide, led a court case that went to the appellate courts, and it ruled that ballot images in the state of New York are a public record for anybody to get. That's great news.
Well, tell us what that means in practical terms.
What that means is that there's going to be a day in this country that we could prove if Mark Twain was here. You know, Mark Twain used to say that if elections were real, they wouldn't let us do it. We believe that he probably was very much right. We need proof that elections are real. We are demanding the right to verify elections. And how that should be done is immediately, election night, from the precincts, the results of these digital scanners are published online with the ballot images, and that anybody could verify. Because the reality is, what does the machine count? It counts these images. And all they got to do is put them online by precinct, and then people could verify at their own home by taking their laptop, plugging it into a computer, to a TV, I should say. And at that point right there, you invite some neighbors over, get some clickers. We got a little program that you could set up, and then you could sit there and you could verify elections. And by doing that, we've immunized the system from hackers, because hackers only steal if they know they can get away with it. And how this whole thing really started, this thinking process, was when we all watched Karl Rove freak out election night in 2012 because of your crime partner. What he did in Ohio with one of my people, Mickey Donahoe, remember?
No, tell us.
Well, Bob took him to court, and he had Mickey Donahoe, and they were trying to do a sneak patch into the system because they had to change something all across the whole spectrum of all the machines. And so Bob took him to court, and Mickey Donahoe, the NSA guy, testified. He was 37 years and explained how dangerous this was. And then Bob put on other evidence that the judge kept the case open and the right to go in and do verification. And because of that, we think that that took away the impunity of the people working for Karl Rove to pull the trigger, because they were afraid to make the adjustments. And, you know, that's what it's about, being proactive and getting ahead of these guys.
So, John,
we can make elections transparent, trackable, and publicly verified is the goal. Crowd checking, you could say.
So what states have you been in, and where do we stand now? You know, we're headed into an election, a 2018 election, that will determine the fate of the future of this country.
Yes.
If Donald Trump emerges from the midterm election with a majority in either House of Congress, you know, we're basically done for. So
yeah, we are.
How would you characterize the ability of the American people at this point in time to have any faith whatsoever in the alleged vote counts that we're going to be looking at come November?
You know, it's a scary thing, and because we know that, you know, we went through this in 2006. Okay, it was the same kind of atmosphere, not as big as this one. This is big. This is a huge wave coming. And we know that the Trump administration has worked very hard getting all the voting data in, okay? And we know that when we talk about the world of elections in this country, that it's a three-front war that we fight. We know that election fraud is real, okay? We've seen it. We've witnessed it. We've recorded it. Tim Cadova in his election, Chicago, California. I can go over and over. We know that the second part of the big problem is voter suppression, Jim Crow. But Jim Crow, it's popping up in our computer, in the social media, and they're micro-targeting people, social, you know, they're psycho-targeting. And then, of course, you know, this is why we have to work so hard, all of us right now, in this election in 2020, is because in 2020, well, there goes the census, and now more gerrymandering. And we know that gerrymandering gives the radical parts of both parties a 6 to 8 point lead. That when you the real election is in the primary, it's not in the general. And if we don't fix that, then I think we're going to slip over to fascism, if we're not already there.
Yeah, well, thankfully Paul Ryan is leaving us. Hopefully we'll, somebody decent will get that Senate, that House seat. And, of course, even at this, with fair elections, we wind up with corporate Democrats who aren't all that much better than the Republicans. But at least
totally.
It'll be a counterbalance to the lunatic in the White House. So do we have, John Brakey, any states that can serve as a model for how it should be done in this upcoming election?
Yeah, there are. You know, I'm glad to be able to say that there are. I mean, that's a real pleasing thing, because I don't want to be, you know, Downer Debbie or Downer John. And, you know, I went on a 7-state tour, and I'm very proud to see what Maryland's doing and how they've identified ballot images, how they'd be preserved, how they'd be handled. And I think that a candidate can just request them. Just, nobody has yet. And I think that's going to change in this coming cycle. I think the state of Maine has done a good job. I've met with the Secretary of State up there, and, you know, this coming June, it looks like there are problems still, but they may be the whole state is going to have their first election, which is called ranked choice voting. And that means, hey, folks, in the state of Maine, you can vote for hope first before you vote for the last of two evils. Because how many times have you been in a ballot box and you say, boy, these are both really bad, but I'm going to vote against this one because he's worse than the other. And when there's a Jill Stein on the ticket, and, you know, I voted for Jill. My wife said she was, but when she got there, she said, I panicked. I knew that I was throwing my vote away with Jill, and I couldn't stand Trump, so she voted for Hillary. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that this machine has us thinking.
Well, so if I'm in I'm in California, and there are plenty of problems with the California system. So if I am advocating a change in the system here, what are the specifics of what is installed in the states that you find acceptable that I would want to advocate here in California?
Well, in California, yeah, that's an interesting state. I mean, you know, I canvassed that really hard, and I think I complimented your book, except I added a new part to it. You know, you had the strip and flip. Well, I added the front end to it called the stack strip and a flip, okay? And, you know, stacking is, I think, what happened in the 2016. In fact, I know it was because the results show it. You know, Hillary Clinton wins in California, the vote by mail by an average of 66% election night when the first returns came out. Then at the precinct, they stripped people. They wrote 825,000 provisionals, and she only wins the state and that rank by maybe a half a percent. But like I said, they had to force 800,000 plus people into provisionals, okay? And then, guess what? We don't audit the rest, which is 36% of the vote. So that's where we flip. That's why I call it a stack, strip, and flip state. And right now, they passed the law after we won a court case. Larry Lutz did, a great guy out of San Diego, okay, who won a case ordering them to do that. And what do? They go to the legislators and say, we don't need to do this, because that's how they can steal. These machines that are verifying these vote-by-mail ballots are not totally being verified by eye, okay? They're verified by a computer, and these computers are working live, and, you know, they know how you're going to vote because you put it on your Facebook page, you put it on Google, you donated money, and they know that. They know everything that we're doing if they want to know. Scary, isn't it?
It is scary. We're talking with John Brakey here, one of the nation's leading election protection activists. He's doing a national tour to see what kinds of election systems are in place in various states around the country. And it ain't looking good. Let's put it that way.
No, it isn't, but we're on the move, and if people want to get involved, you know, I could encourage, if you can help donate money, please do. These cases are expensive, but, you know, they're not. They're really inexpensive because, in fact, if we don't do something like this and be proactive, we're going to be really in big trouble. We really are, Harvey.
Well, we are in big trouble now, and thanks to you, maybe a little less so. John Brakey, thanks for your great work. How do people get a hold of you?
Best way is to go to my site. I'll give you my email, too. My site is auditelectionsusa.org, and my email is johnbrakey@gmail.com, and thank you, Harvey.
Thank you, buddy. Keep up your great work. Thanks to the crew in New York. We'll be back with you next week in Solartopia, where your vote will be counted.
Started to burn many things we've found, but
don't you know?